The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. It's a delight to speak about A.M. Klein, whom I had the pleasure of meeting at one point, and maybe that would come up later in the discussion. Montreal is 372 miles from New York City, the same distance as Buffalo. For Jews, though, it has always been the much more traveled route. Montreal was on the itinerary of the New York Yiddish theater companies and all the American Jewish speakers who were on the circuit. Jewish writers and poets in the two cities published in one another's magazines, and they all sought support from the same donors, because in many cases, certainly in the case of the Yiddish publications, you did not put out a book if you did not have some subsidy for it. And Montreal was a very good place of support for people seeking support for Yiddish projects. So despite its much smaller population, the Montreal Jewish community was known to have certain cultural advantages over its southern neighbor, all of which figured in the career of Abraham Moses Klein, who was also Canada's most famous Jewish poet before Leonard Cohen. So including Klein among the American Jewish intellectuals, I do this, although he is better known as a Canadian poet. And this lets us better understand how language and environment defined the cultural opportunities of those who settled by the waters of Manhattan, in the phrase of another American Jewish poet, Charles Reznikoff, as opposed to those who made their home in the mouth of the St. Lawrence. New York was the magnet city, of course, for Jewish creativity, but Montreal encouraged Jews to form their own piece of the Canadian mosaic rather than blend into the melting pot. Yiddish was Klein's native language, English his language of composition, and he was almost equally at home in Hebrew and French. Except for Hebrew, this was also true of locally born Saul Bellow. Bellow was born in Lachine, which is a suburb of Montreal, and his family, however, moved him to Chicago when he was 9, whereas Klein remained a genuine hybrid of Jewish and Canadian culture. This kept him more an insider in both Jewish and general society than his American counterparts were in either of them. And perhaps this will become clearer when one talks more about him and Canada. So that Klein was born in Ratno, Ukraine, didn't figure very much in his life since his parents emigrated the year of his birth and he was officially registered as born in Montreal, Quebec, on February the 14th, 1909. Abraham Moses grew up deeply attached to his new world shtetl, which is the way it sort of figures for him, his registered birthplace and his permanent home. Separation is the default theme of Yiddish and Hebrew writers who almost always left and almost never ended up where they began. And for American Jewish writers who made a point of emphasizing their emigration within the same city, their internal emigration, like Alfred Kazin, for example, telling us of how it felt to leave his cocoon of the city in Brooklyn, and Norman Podhoretz, who begins one of his books by saying that one of the longest journeys in the world is the journey from Brooklyn to Manhattan. or at least from his neighborhood and certain parts of Manhattan. Klein, by contrast, wanted to be known as the native Jew of his neighborhood in that polyglot, multicultural, multi-ethnic country of Canada and city of Montreal. And this is one of the beginning of his poem called Autobiography. Out of the ghetto streets where a Jew boy dreamed pavement into pleasant Bible land, out of the Yiddish slums where childhood met the friendly beard, the loutish Sabbath goy, or followed proud the Torah escorting band, out of the jargoning city I regret, rise memories like sparrows rising from the gutter scattered oats, like sadness sweet of synagogal hum, like Hebrew violins sobbing delight upon their Eastern notes. This passage from the poem Autobiographical uses the trope of the ghetto affectionately for the voluntary Jewish neighborhood of Montreal and cheerfully assumes the identity of Jew boy that might elsewhere have been hurled as a slur. Klein's father had seen to it that while attending Protestant school, which was the assigned place for Jews in Quebec's confessional school system, that his son was also well-schooled in Hebrew and in Talmud, so that he could dream pavement into Bible land and join the procession to the synagogue for escorting a newly commissioned Torah scroll, which are the references in this poem. The poet tells us that absorbing the composite influences, both friendly and not so friendly, readied him for both celebration and sorrow. In Montreal, where people pride themselves on staying ethnic, religious, linguistically distinct, where the French want to stay French and the English, English, the Jew felt encouraged, if not absolutely obliged, to stay Jewish. Very different from the cultural situation in a city like New York, but even more so in the rest of America. So A.M. Klein, as he signed himself, discovered his first literary community early on as an undergraduate when he was at McGill University. Their set of poets became known as the Montreal Group, with a reputation for challenging the Victorian Canadian literary establishment. Poet Frank Scott became a professor of law. Leon Edel, the renowned biographer of Henry James, A.J.M. Smith and Leo Kennedy became prolific poets and editors who brought Canadian poetry into the academy and out to the public. None of them was bohemian, nor were they demi-aristocrats like the Bloomsbury group in England. They all experienced and expressed the tensions of living as family members and citizens while serving the uncompromising demands of art. They were an English minority within a French majority that was itself a minority within an English-Canadian majority. So Klein's Jewishness added just another element in that multi-ethnic mix. One feature, however, that distinguished Klein from others in the group, including from his fellow Jew, Leon Edel, was his immersion in Jewish communal affairs. During his undergraduate studies at McGill and then at law school at the French Université de Montréal, where he was educated, he became the director of the Canadian branch of Young Judea and published his first poems in the Zionist monthly, The Judean. In his years of active law practice, he edited the Canadian Zionist, later the Canadian Jewish Chronicle, which gave him an outlet for his own work that included translations from Hebrew and Yiddish poetry. And I can't tell you how much credit he deserves, because some of the finest translations that we have, including of Bialik's famous poem, Be'ira Harega, in the City of Slaughter, was done by Klein, who really brought Hebrew and Yiddish poetry to the attention of any American and Canadian reader, any English reader who wanted to have that access. He published his first books of poetry, his first book, Hath Not a Jew, through the Berman Jewish publishing house in New York and the Hitleriad in New York in 1944. His first book to be published in Canada, The Rocking Chair and Other Poems in 1948, won the Governor General's Medal for Poetry in the same year that he was traveling to Israel, Europe, and North Africa on a fact-finding mission about the fate of Hitler's refugees. So complicated as it was to balance the various claims of identity and engagement, his professional and community obligations, this combination enriched his writing as much as these complications might have interfered with his writing. Klein had not only studied law, but unlike Jacob Glotstein, who left law for literature, he practiced law for many years in tandem with his literary career. He became a public figure in Quebec and in the largely immigrant Jewish community, which was a generation younger than that of the United States in the sense that it expanded and developed once the United States restricted immigration following the First World War. This quality of lateness, you see, further explains why Yiddish remained alive in Montreal during the interwar period and why Canadian Jews stayed more closely involved with those in Europe and Palestine. Jewish day schools flourished as nowhere else on the continent, reflecting every shred, every shade of affiliation, communist, socialist, left and right Zionist, centrist Zionist, religious Zionist, and what later came to be known as ultra-Orthodox. In that fractured and contentious environment, Klein was a culturally and religiously heterodox Zionist. His literary and public life merged most unusually in 1939, when he was employed by Samuel Bronfman, the distiller turned philanthropist owner of Seagram's, whom the Canadian Jewish Congress had drafted to lead its emergency efforts. Now, this collaboration between the community's wealthiest Jew and its foremost rabbi was solidly in the tradition of diaspora leadership. That's what communities did. But modern Jewish intellectuals, unlike their rabbinic forebears, generally cast themselves in opposition to their bourgeois society, while Jews who gained great wealth, like Bronfman, usually sought prominence in Gentile rather than in Jewish circles. You see, it's unusual in that respect, but Montreal, as I've said, lagged behind the United States in ways that put it ahead in all that concerned Jewish self-affirmation. The anxieties of Canadian Jews over the situation in Europe were compounded by local anti-Semitism, whose gentlemanly English version was incorporated in government policy that allowed no Jews into Canada during the Second World War, while French-Canadian anti-Jewish sentiment, stoked by the Catholic Church, was manifest in calls for Jewish business boycotts. So, in this threatening time, these two exceptional men, Bronfman the distiller and Klein the poet, allowed themselves to be conscripted in a unique alliance. Klein's work for Bronfman as head of the Jewish Congress brought him financial support and, by all accounts, also an interesting friendship. If it also ruffled his pride, he could enjoy his literary revenge. For example, he would write like this: "Rejoicing and drinks, the maestros, at the planning of the final banquet of the annual philanthropic campaign. Everybody complimented by everybody, even me, who am only the author of its slogans, the proxy of the poor, the compiler of its sob letters. Particular backslap for an anonymous poem about the grace of charity. Ah, the charm of gilded platitude printed on the banquet souvenir program. Poor me, poet parsley ate to a menu." Actually, The sonnet was written only to avoid writing the sickening prose called for on the premises, but that I should write it at all, it is a humiliation only a philanthropic world makes possible. Poor me, poet Parsley 8, is the common complaint of the creative artist who feels that he prostitutes his talent. But Klein really did not have to be coerced into defending the Jews. He resented only being part of the coarse means, as he thought it, for raising the money needed to address the crises. And Montreal's Canadian Jewish Congress and Federation used marvelously crude means. One of the delights of my childhood was what I would call the, I called the blackmail booklet. And it listed every donor over $25 and everything that they gave that year and the year before. And so we could, so this was a community that knew how to raise money and was not worried about refinement. And so from Klein's perspective, this was sometimes a difficulty. But in any case, his engagement with the fate of the Jews contrasts quite notably with the cohort of his American Jewish counterparts who paid little attention at the time to the trials of their fellow Jews in Europe and Palestine. When asked about this many years later, Saul Bellow said, "America was not a country to us, it was the world." And these children of immigrants with great literary aspirations were caught up by the challenges and opportunities right there in front of them, which did not yet include responsibility for the rest of the Jewish people. Whereas those in the sphere of Yiddish, like Glotstein, felt their heads exploding under the barrage of daily news, young Jews in the sphere of English, who knew all about the travails of Leon Trotsky, interested themselves not at all about Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky. Just how exceptional Klein was, we see from the Hitleriad, the book-length poem that he wrote in the heat of the war. He must have known that this satire could never accomplish its purpose by bringing down Hitler, any more than Charlie Chaplin had done in his 1940 film, The Great Dictator. But he dared it anyway. See, Alexander Pope's intricate epic satire, The Dunciad, mocks contemporary writers. In other words, Pope mocked everybody but himself, and he considered them dunces. But Klein targets not inferior art, but superior evil. "Heil, heavenly muse, since also thou must be, like my song's theme, a Sieg-heiled deity. Be with me now, but not as once for song. Not odes do I indite, inditing wrong. Be with me, for I fall from grace to sin, spurning this day thy proffered hippocrene to taste the poisoned lager of Berlin." So the poet says that instead of reaching for perfect expression under the influence of Hippocrene, the spring of muses in Greek mythology that brings inspiration, he is going to sink to the dregs to write about Hitler. In 27 sections of rhyming verse, Klein tells the story of Hitler's rise. "His teachers have since died, and fortunate they, who else had died 10 deaths to see the day, the dunce of the corner corner better men, and great wealth his who could only count to 10. The poem mocks Hitler's ineptitude, his cowardice, his insane ability to win over the once cultured German people. It introduces his henchmen, his fellow convict Rudolf Hess, club-footed and rat-faced Goebbels, Goering, who loved hunting, preferably biped quarry, loved art, if stolen. The poem exposes those who, out of naivete or stupidity, let him rise to power. But was there not, to cope with this intrigue, to keep the peace, the wise Wilsonian League, the League of Nations? What a hope was there, fled with the years, vanished in spoken air." So Klein pours out his wrath, seeking the justice for that voice which cries out of the ground, the voice of our brother's blood. Now, calls for justice had been sounding since Cain murdered Abel. Klein felt compelled to write this poem, and if his attempt to shoot down the scum from a lofty Anglophone perch did not make for great poetry, this purgation of rage may have cleared the way for the greater work that was soon to celebrate the resurrection of Zion. Now, before getting to that, though, let's note that in the very years that he was consumed by Jewish affairs, Klein won the country's highest literary honor, as I've said, for a book that brought French Canadians into English Canadian literary sphere. The Rocking Chair is Klein's appreciative and deeply intelligent engagement with his fellow Quebecers, mostly the French Canadians, with whom, despite their sometimes show of hostility, he felt real kinship, and he worked among them all his life as a lawyer. If we think it unusual that the passionate Jew should have been the one among his English contemporaries to feel the deepest affinity for French Canada, consider Franz Kafka's circle of Jewish intellectuals in multi-ethnic Prague, whose growing attachment to Jewishness and involvement with Zionism had simultaneously drawn them closer to the Czech writers who were strengthening their language and culture in the dominant sphere of German. So because they were writing in the dominant language, Kafka in German and Klein in English, they may both have harbored a special respect for those who were preserving their own language and culture. Many reasons for this affinity, but it is a striking parallel, I think. The Rocking Chair is a candid Jew's impression of French Canada. The defeat of Nazism had discredited Quebec anti-Semitism, allowing Klein to mock the demagogic mayor of Montreal, who had opposed Canada's entry into World War II, and others who were explicitly hostile to the Jews. So his book of poetry contains those kind of poems too. But reviewers rightly noted the positive potential of tradition that attracted Klein to the still largely traditional local society. Heard in the clean, lamplit farmhouses of Quebec, the Rocking Chair was a symbol of a folk that moves in place and always returns to base, as if always back to a first love. Klein's affectionate attempt to characterize a people colored by hopes for his own people reveals that he felt comfortable enough as a Jew to write as he pleased about the surrounding society. Now, Klein's civic engagement was not limited to his work at the Canadian Jewish Congress either. In 1949, he was drafted by Canada's Socialist Party, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation called the CCF, to run as its candidate in the national election representing his native district of Cartier. The largely Jewish district was already represented by a Jew of the Liberal Party, but Klein's recent Governor General's Award for Poetry and his prominence as editor and public speaker encouraged hope that he could prevail as a mild socialist, passionate Zionist, vieil ami, old friend to the French Canadians, and admired public intellectuals. Well, that he ultimately received fewer votes than even the second place communist candidate that year. That was a year of liberal sweep throughout Canada. This put an end to his political career. But had it not been for that defeat, we would not have had the novel, The Second Scroll. So in the spring of 1949, the Canadian Jewish Congress asked Klein to undertake a fact-finding mission to Israel and to several Jewish refugee points in Western Europe and North Africa. And he was to write about this, to raise awareness of the enormous national task that lay ahead. As the ninth person to be issued a visa at the Israeli consulate in Montreal, he noted, Klein, nine, sign, fine. He was very playful as well. And anyway, his buoyant reports published serially in his own publication, the Canadian Jewish Chronicle, laid the foundation for this novel that he would publish 3 years later. Its scheme was pretty simple. He had only to slightly abridge and rearrange the order of his actual mission that took him to Israel, Italy, and Morocco, and the trajectory of the biblical exodus from slavery to freedom was there basically ready-made. Klein cast his autobiographical self as the narrator of the Second Scroll, who sets out on a fictionalized version of his Canadian Jewish Congress mission. So A.M., as I will call him for the sake of summary, has been sent to Israel by his publisher to compile an anthology of modern Hebrew verse in English translation. This is the realistic level of the story, but having learned of the survival of his mother's brother, he is also searching for this lost relative whose name is Melech Davidson, King, Son of David, as close as one can come to naming the Messiah. This character, Melech Davidson, is at once the historical, evolving, political Jew, and also the embodiment of the messianic ideal that cannot be satisfied in political terms alone. He is pursued, but never caught up with. The two-pronged mission of the novel, of compiling the anthology and finding Melech Davidson, this integrates the national, historical, and spiritually symbolic parts of Zionism, and also the culture of evolving state of Israel. The opening paragraph telegraphs what an odd book this is going to be. For many years, my father, may he dwell in a bright Eden, refused to permit in his presence even the mention of that person's name. The mere imminence of an allusion to my uncle soon brought my father to an oblique, deliberative, ominous knuckle-combing of his beard, a somber knitting of his brow, and froze at last his face to the stony stare Semitic. The taboo was recognized, and the subject was dropped. The very language here is puzzling, an elevated, slightly foreign version of our daily tongue. May he dwell in a bright Eden is imported from Yiddish, a highly inflected language that bestows posthumous blessing when mentioning a beloved deceased. Eden, the earthly setting of the book of Genesis, is likewise the opening chapter of this book, which is arranged in five chapters according to the Torah, including according to the Pentateuch. Thus, the Second Scroll is this novel modeled deliberately on the First Scroll. In plain English, this opening says, "My father got so angry when I mentioned my uncle that I dropped the subject." But written as it is, it also recalls the creator of the world who punished the original sinners by expelling them from the garden. We soon learn why this incensed father forbade mention of the sinner. In the book then called the Second Scroll, shall we say that we have to read it in the shadow of the original? Well, I think absolutely. In fact, the better you know the Pentateuch, the more you appreciate the textual interplay, which is there in every line. So the banished uncle is Melech Davidson, his mother's brother, a Talmudic genius who had stayed behind in Ratno and to whom young A.M. had been expectantly compared in the way that intellectually gifted boys were the wished-for future authorities of diaspora communities. But something terrible had happened. A traumatic pogrom had turned Melech to Bolshevism, and in his role as Comrade Cruel, he became an intellectual force in the Communist Party, earning him the father's condemnation and his nephew's admiration. It is no secret how much Jewish brain power and habits of thought went into actualizing Marxism, or how many budding intellectuals of Klein's generation accepted the Bolshevik claim that the incorporation of communism in the Soviet Union would mark the liberation of all humanity. Yet, just as the pogrom in Ratno led this devout Jew to communism, so the horrors that he subsequently experienced during the Nazi genocide return him to Jewishness and to his family. A letter from Melech, addressed to the narrators by then-deceased parents, is forwarded to him, chronicling the uncle's survival and regret. He should have known better than to turn cruel. Now, you see how this plays? Cruel, comrade cruel, the first time you see it is K-R-U-L. But then you understand that the homonym is obviously intended. He writes, from a displaced persons camp in Italy, where he waits to board a ship to the land of Israel. So when the narrator sets off to Israel to compile his anthology of Hebrew verse, he goes via Europe, determined to find Melech during his overseas mission. But like the Bible's 40 years of wandering in the desert, wherever the narrator expects a reunion, he discovers that Melech has already passed on to something else. And in this way, we follow Melech's encounter with the main moral intellectual challenges to modern Jewry. We tend to forget, for example, how many Jews converted to Christianity, both before the war and during the war and after the war, under various kinds of pressure. So the manager of the DP camp directs him, he's looking for Melech Davidson, you have to go to find Monsignor Peter Santi, right? The St. Peter who sends Davidson to the Sistine Chapel in an effort to convince him of Christianity's supersession. Melech is deeply affected by the Sistine Chapel, but not as the prelate imagined. Struck by the contrast between this lofty conception and the events to which he has just been witness, Melech sends the Monsignor a full interpretation of those mighty panels, showing, quote, the manner in which Christian history has interpreted Christian art. This treasure of art criticism appears at the back of the book as a gloss on this chapter. And each of the five chapters has such a gloss that evokes the Talmud's commentaries on the Bible, which became part of its canonical status. But in this book, the glosses, of course, really flesh out what was told to us in those chapters. Though incorporating this Jewish way of reading allowed Klein to introduce his own commentaries, the book's latest edition, and this was put out with a great subsidy from the Canadian government, has 57 pages of the main story, 48 for the five glosses, followed by 70 pages of the editor's explanatory notes. I think a college teacher's ideal text, right? So the idea of writing in the shadow of epic grandeur, Klein had adapted from James Joyce's Ulysses, the most influential English novel of the 20th century, about which Klein was writing a Talmudic commentary. He finished the first chapter. He never finished the whole of it. So the second scroll is to the Pentateuch, as Joyce's Dubliners are to Homer's Odyssey. But whereas Joyce enjoys the comic reduction of the modern story, Klein elevates the Exodus of his time to the level of the original in English prose, heightened and enhanced for the biblical scale story that he had come to tell. Now, as A.M., the narrator, gathers material for the projected anthology of the new Hebrew verse, he includes, by the way, fragments of their poetry, which he has translated here for us into English. He is even more excited by the Hebrew creativity in the everyday language. He writes, they were not members of literary societies, the men who were giving new life to the antique speech, but merchants, tradesmen, day laborers. In their daily activity and without pose or flourish, they showed it to be alive again, the shaping Hebrew imagination. An insurance company, I observed as I lingered in Tel Aviv's commercial center, called itself Sneh, after Moses' burning bush, which had burned and burned, but had not been consumed. A well-known brand of Israeli sausage was being advertised, it gladdened my heart to see, as Bashan. Just tribute to its magnum size, royal compliment descended from Og, Bashan's giant king. A dry cleaner called its firm Keshet, the rainbow symbol of cessation of floods, and so on. So, quoting Ezekiel's prophecy, the narrator tells us, it was as if I was spectator to the healing of torn flesh, or her broken bone come together, set, and grow again. He hears the dead bones coming together, bone to bone, in the resurrection of spoken Hebrew, and this creative use of it. So the dream of Zion is recognized and realized, but not completely. As the biblical Moses anticlimactically never enters the promised land to which he has led the Jews, so our narrator never catches up with his uncle. Leaving Italy, Melech had felt compelled to help gather up and lead his fellow Jews out of the Mela of Morocco, the Middle Eastern equivalent of the Western ghetto. But then, having reached Israel, he is killed in an Arab ambush. His attackers burn the body in gasoline, thus anointing the martyr. The messianic spirit of Melech Davidson anoints the newborn state, which is continuing to fight for its life. So the interwoven biblical past with the Israeli present is part of the fabric of this book. The murder of Melech Davidson occurs in Tzfat, in Safed, holy city on whose hills once were kindled, as now again, the beacons announcing new moons, festivals, and set times. In ancient Israel, before the Jewish calendar was set, the new moons and times of festivals were set by Tzfat. It is striking that Klein ends his novel not in Jerusalem, the seat of government, but in the mystical or symbolic sphere where the book itself has to be situated. In attempting to compress the full intellectual, political, cultural, and historic process through which Jews were resurrected as a people, did Klein's ambition for this novel exceed its grasp? He reconfigurated English and the form of the novel to convey the marvel as he experienced it. How well the miracle works for us is for each reader to decide. A simple book to read, it is not, but rewarding certainly for those who love this kind of challenge. But to fully appreciate Klein's daredevil feat, we need only consult what was then happening among his contemporaries, those 372 miles to the south. Leslie Fiedler's essay, What Can We Do About Fagin? The Jew Villain in the Western Tradition, in the May 1949 issue of Commentary, ignited a large-scale symposium of how American Jewish writers were going to deal with the image of the Jew in the literature that they were entering. Fiedler articulated the real problem of writing within a literary culture with such deeply embedded negative images of the Jew. So that was the challenge he set down in his essay, and Commentary then asked all the writers of the time to respond to it. Responses ran from a denial that such a problem even existed to suggestions that they, the contemporary American Jewish writers, would counteract the paradigm with better portrayals. All the contributors insisted on the independence of literature from any Jewish national purpose. None proposed to address what the Jews had just undergone or achieved. So Klein's unique book was treated cautiously with the respect that you give to a foreign object. Unfortunately, Klein's own creative life ended soon after. In the early 50s, writes his biographer, Usher Kaplan, Klein suffered a gradual mental breakdown, By the end of the decade, he had lapsed into an almost total silence, which remained unbroken until his death in 1972. Kaplan does not speculate over what had silenced him, but the mystery of that silence became part of his biography. His reputation continued to grow for decades after his death, clouded by the unfinished quality, that unfinished aspect of his life. When Leonard Cohen was just starting out as a poet, before he began setting his words to music, he wrote several poems to his teacher, as he called him, A.M. Klein. Now, Klein had never formally, of course, been his teacher, but what he meant was that he was the person whom he regarded as his forerunner in poetry. A.M. Klein, one of these poems that he wrote, addresses Klein in the mental hospital, alluding to his attempted suicide, which had become part of the legend. And this is Cohen's poem. Hurt once and for all into silence, a long pain ending without a song to prove it. Who could stand beside you so close to Eden when you glinted in every eye the held-high razor, shivering every ram and sun? And now, the silent loony bin, where the shadows live in the rafters, like day-weary bats, until the turning mind, a radar signal, lures them to exaggerate mountain size on the white stone wall, your tiny limp. How can I leave you in such a house? There is a film that was made by David Kaufman some 40 years ago, a documentary film about A.M. Klein, which I learned has just been digitized and is available. This is kind of a resurrection. But one of the subjects of that film is also what happened. How could this great luminary, this great poet, end in such a form? So Cohen was never formally Klein's student, but he loved to acknowledge the two Montreal Jewish poets, Klein and Irving Layton, who had freely, demonstratively created a new branch of Jewish poetry in English and a new branch of Canadian poetry as Jews. Cohen himself moved far beyond the Canadian scene and the Canadian Jewish scene while remaining rooted in his native soil. Now, Klein has yet to move out into the broader world of English, North American, and world culture. And I think that's why we're here. Getting him there is part of our privileged obligation. Thank you.